Hello, listener. Are you a Baz leaver yet? England experienced a new high in Hyderabad as Ben Stokes and his team pulled off one of the great test victories, even if it had to fight for top spot on the day, as West Indies also did the unthinkable at the Gabba. India have a better record at home than Godzilla in Tokyo, but England not only handed them their fourth defeat in 48 matches, they did so after conceding a 190-run deficit on first innings. Despite being in the gutter, they shot for the stars. Ollie Pope's magnificent 196 turning the game around before debutant Tom Hartley capped a personal and collective comeback with a 7-wicket haul. It was rollicking, record-breaking stuff, but then that's what we've come to expect of the Bazball era. Joining me to reflect on the new norm, having had 48 hours to collect their thoughts, are Andrew Miller and Matt Boller. But first up, let's hear from our man on the ground in India, Vitushan Ihantaraja. How's it going, Vish? And can you please explain what we just witnessed?
So what we witnessed was a team coming from behind, having been 190 runs in arrears to India after the first innings, where on day one, Ben Duckett told us that Ben Stokes' 70 in what looked a subpar 240 score was going to be match-winning, followed by Jeetan Patel, assistant coach, on Tuesday, or rather on day two, tell us that this England team never gives up, that they won't be concentrating on the scoreboard, that there is no real pressure, that the runs don't matter. All that matters is how they get to the end point. And then both things came true, despite the fact that halfway through this game, it felt like another one of those England test matches in India. It's one of the most remarkable things I've seen, if not the most remarkable test match I've seen. And I think there was a moment there was a moment on day four when they were, maybe when Tom Hartley removed Akshar Patel, caught and bowled after tea, when I thought, oh my God, they're going to do it. And I'm so glad that I'm here to watch them do it, because, you know, of all the things that they've done under Ben Stokes, it's been about, you know, doing the amazing and doing the remarkable and scoring quickly and attacking in the field. And I think they were asked to go to a place that they hadn't been before. And not only did they go there, but they skipped there. They were happy to be there. They were happy to be in the pits, you know, in the mire. And it showed at the end. They did a number on the best team, one of the best teams in the world, one of the most accomplished teams in terms of making the most of home advantage and making opponents, certainly touring opponents, feel very, very small indeed. And, you know, we'll probably go into how India were, I don't know, culpable in some way. The fact that they're missing Virat Kohli, who of all the people you wanted to chase, Virat Kohli is number one. But it was stunning, really. And the reason why so many people, you know, not just a very excitable me, but so many other people who know what they're talking about, regard this as perhaps England's best overseas test win.
Yeah, it's certainly up there in that conversation, is it? You mentioned kind of the way the game's going after a couple of days. I think Jeetan Patel's press conference, you know, putting it kindly, sounded a bit mad. But I mean, you've seen some crazy things. This team did some crazy things under Stokes and McCullum. At what point did it begin to dawn? Did people realise around the ground in the press box, say, that actually England were in this and actually they were going to do it again?
I mean, it was the, you know, the Tom Hartley bang bang at the start, I think. I mean, getting rid of the guy who carded your first ball for six a couple of days earlier, and then removing Shubman Gill. I mean, he took the first four wickets, having only had two in the first innings, because, you know, they were caught a deep mid wicket. That was probably when you got a sense in the ground as well that, you know, the India fans were a bit like, what's going on here? And then when you look down that batting order, while it is deep, it was missing one other superstar that comes in and, you know, makes the opponent think, right, however hard we've worked to get to this point, we need to work even harder. But yeah, it was, with all the talk leading into this series, whether it was about selection, whether it was about preparation, whether it was even about, you know, the lack of cricket that these players have played recently, I never thought we'd get 4 days into the tour where all of it would be vindicated, where all the worries were, you know, don't worry at all, they've got this. 4 days, yeah. Bear in mind, 2 days, all those things were still to blame. In fact, we had probably had more evidence to blame those things. You know, obviously it's a long series, there's 4 more tests to go. But, I said at the start of this that getting a test would be deemed a success. And they've already ticked that off.
Stokes said it was the greatest win of his captaincy. I mean, we've talked about, you've mentioned whether it's the greatest overseas win of all time. I mean, what is... it's hard to put this stuff into words, really, but we keep saying it about Stokes and McCullum and Bazball. I mean, this kind of... we're on a level of sort of voodoo Jedi mind trick here as to how everything that they seem to do pays off, whether it's bowling, they're playing two spinners with one test between them and a handful of first-class matches. And then, as you mentioned, Hartley's turnaround, you know, getting hit for six first ball and fourth ball and getting 2 for 130 or whatever it was in the first innings, then comes back and takes a 7 for Ollie Pope, 1 off 11 in the first innings, and then one of the great overseas innings by an English batter in the second. And it all just seems to run on vibes and fumes and a wink from Ben Stokes.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I don't disagree that it's vibes, but there's also... There's also a lot more to it, and I don't even know really where to start. I mean, you know, the timeout in Abu Dhabi was really interesting because there was a lot of talk about, you know, they should have gone earlier, that they can't quite replicate the the pitches that they get in India, in the UAE, despite, you know, all the money and facilities and the quality of facilities, I suppose, in the region. But actually, when we got to that fourth day, the wicket that Tom Hartley was bowling on was the wicket he'd been bowling on in the UAE. It just so happens that rather than three days of a test match on a pitch that was already turning from day one, they got the ground staff in the UAE to rake the pitch. They put sawdust down, they put sand down. And because of that, Tom Hartley had 10 days or so where all he had to do was find the length and hit it. And on day three, the pitch that Ollie Pope was batting on was akin to those pitches. It was by no means as extreme as those pitches. But because he'd had the experience of doing that, because he'd been, he'd been made a fool of on those pitches and, you know, dusted himself off and still kept sweeping, still kept reverse sweeping, he was kind of unperturbed by, I suppose, the false shots. And there were 74 false shots, maybe 75, I think, by our measure. And his enthusiasm remained undimmed throughout. And that is because of the planning, really. And then we can extend it a little bit further in that, you know, they pick someone like Tom Hartley for his height. I think, you know, the intimation there was, well, that we took from it was bounce, when actually it's the dip. When the ball comes from that high, the dip gets batters, I suppose, falling over in the way that maybe they'd fall over sideways in England when the ball's moving about horizontally. And you saw that with a few of his dismissals. You know, you can probably attribute Rohit to being done by that dip. Maybe Bharat as well, having looked quite solid, was pressing forward and not getting to the pitch of the ball and then seeing it spin past and hit his off stump. And there's also, you know... far be it for, we might have a few people turning off. You just want to listen to test, you know, about test cricket, especially about one of these great test wins. But there's a lot to be said for white ball cricket in the story of Tom Hartley. He's someone who, across all T20, and that includes the 100, has bowled, you know, just over a quarter, or let's say one of his four overs in the power play, where he knows he's going to be hit. He knows he's going to be bowling to the best batters in the world. And he knows that, you know, as bad as his figures might be after certain games, he can't take it personally. And obviously he was dismayed by, you know, how badly his first day went, how badly his first ball went in Test cricket. But ultimately, he was able to shake it off and bowl England to victory, take a 7 for, you know, in India. It's remarkable. It's absolutely, you know, there are vibes involved. The fact that he came off the pitch on day one and he was feeling a bit sorry for himself, and all anyone was saying to him was, God, how cool was that 6 you hit off Ravi Ashwin? But there's also a lot of work that's been put into it that has paid dividends. And I suppose more and more, maybe even before today, I think we've seen how much planning really goes into all this. You think back to the Pakistan tour as well. But essentially, this was the culmination of everything we've seen, and a little bit more in terms of what I said before about just being totally up against it and not doubting.
Yeah, you mentioned sort of that the planning and the level to which they were prepared for this, and I suppose, well, we talked a lot before about Stokes's captaincy of spin and well, captaincy in general. He said after the game about how he was basically a very good observer and he'd been watching what India did in the field. Hartley said he'd learnt from, you know, bowling in the first innings. Adapting, I think bowled at a slower pace in the second innings. And it's, I suppose, you know, that all shows how this England team and Stokes, McCullum, it's easy to sort of to laugh about the way they approach it in quite a carefree manner, but they really have a feel for Test cricket. And as we've said many times, they don't fear losing, even when you're staring at a near 200 run deficit against India in their own conditions, and that has again sort of produced the magic.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Tom Hartley's a third spinner in this era under Stokes and McCullum to have taken a 5-wicket all on debut is remarkable in so very many ways. I mean, the most experienced of them is Will Jacks, who basically only really took up off spin at the start of that 2022 season with Surrey. By that I mean, you know, only really being pushed by Gareth Bay to be the team's spinner, as it were. And yeah, you know, you're right about him being perceptive. I think what's also really interesting was the way he managed Hartley on that first day by getting him to bowl overs. You know, it was said on that evening that, you know, he was never going to be the type of captain to take him off for 2 overs. And it was, you know, and this is at a time when Simon Kerrigan was trending, who obviously had that, you know, awful debut that he'd never quite recovered from. And you look into that match and Kerrigan was taken off after 2 overs. Now, I'm not saying that the story would be any different if they kept him on, especially in the game that England had basically written off to try, you know, blood a few youngsters. You know, Chris Wokes played that test, of course, but they'd won the Ashes. They saw it as, you know, an opportunity to, just see what they got. Just get a cap under someone else's belt. And you know, you wonder without that if this day four performance from Hartley does come about at all. I thought it was really interesting. We spoke to Tom Hartley after the game, and he said that it was really interesting being captained by Stokes because it actually was something that he had to get used to. He said he'd turn to look at a fielder that was there the ball for and they'd be gone. There'd be someone out somewhere else. And rather than being like, hold on, where's so-and-so gone, whether that's cover or whatever, he'd see them maybe like 5-10 yards away at a slightly different angle. And because he'd watched Stokes captain over, you know, these last coming up to 2 years now, he was like, oh, yep, fine. He knows what he's doing. I'm just doing my thing. And that's quite an important thing. You think constant field changes are the product of, I suppose, a team not really knowing what they're doing. A bowler who doesn't really know what he's doing, a captain who doesn't really know what the bowler's going to do. And maybe I'm being, you know, well, absolutely I'm being wise after the event and you know, tying myself in intellectual knots here. But I suppose, actually, if you know where the bowler's going to bowl it, you can keep your covering positions and you do have a couple of attacking positions to play with, really, don't you? And especially in that period in the fourth innings, when Hartley was getting into that groove, you know, Stokes was just playing around here and there. You'd think, you know, you'd think a tinkering is a sign of a confused mind, when really it's, you know, there's something to be said for Stokes' galaxy brain captaincy, because it's been working and it has worked once more. And yeah, you know, Hartley also went on to say that, you know, it was like something of a novelty, just being in that moment, being in a groove where he'd only ever been in the nets, where the ball was spinning so much, and he just really had to put it there and let the pitch do the work, while also, you know, not really having to worry about the field. I suppose it gave him, in what was the most important moment of his career, it gave him very little to think about, very little to worry about, and he excelled.
And just a word on Pope's innings, really, for the significance. He had not, you know, played any cricket. He's had shoulder surgery. His record in India was not particularly impressive. And he got out looking pretty tentative in the first inning. So in the context of a five test series, that innings takes on even greater significance.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think Pope's innings was almost the, I don't know, like it's almost like the combination of someone's weaknesses into their strengths, really. You think of all the chat about Ollie Pope was he's got every shot. The problem is he tries to play, you know, a few of them at the same time. He's a bit too slap happy outside off stump. He doesn't seem to be able to leave the ball alone, which, over here, isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the reverse sweep being people's forward defence. You know, Ben Duckett came out with it before, and Ollie Pope has, you know, taken it on as well. And I think the important thing to kind of say is, you know, it worked in terms of it was a shot that they nailed regularly. And when they didn't nail it, they seemed to, you know, I suppose, morally nail it. Because it would always affect some change, whether it was a change in length from the Indian bowlers or a change in the field, a reinforcement in the field of a particular area that seemed to open up gaps and things like that. You know, there was one Ollie Pope sweep which he completely missed, where he had a man around the corner who was then brought in short third. And then he did it again, but he got the ball on the full, presumably because the bowler, I can't remember who it was thinking, right, if I get this a bit fuller, it's just going to go through him. LBW, bowled, easy. Got it a bit fuller. Pope took a little bit more time on the shot and basically, you know, guided it inside the man who'd just been brought up and away for four. And very soon after that, that man went back. It's just that kind of stuff which seemed to work. And it felt like every time they were finding a fielder, that was their equivalent of just, you know, knocking it back to the bowler. They're not that annoyed when an attacking shot goes to a fielder, in part because they just play more attacking shots now, don't they? And they're not so reliant on that attacking shot going for four. You know, it can be a dot because there'll be another attacking shot a couple of balls later or a ball later. But I suppose to speak more broadly about Pope, you don't really need to take my word for it. Rahul Dravid, who, as we all know, is a modern great of the game, who one of the best players of spin, one of the players that Kevin Peterson, a man who loves to essentially work things out himself. Kevin Peterson once emailed him, asked him how to play spin, and he said he's never seen anyone bat like Ollie Pope in these conditions against that caliber of attack. And that really says it all, really. It says it as much as the numbers 198. It says it, you know, as loudly as the fact that it took England to one of their best wins, a win that has two main characters in Hartley and Pope. It was astounding, really. And I don't really think we'll ever fully appreciate how good it is, because it was so absurd. And that might be unfortunate for Ollie Pope, but I don't really think he cares.
Well, you've got four tests. You've got a whole tour to try and get your head around it. And given it's an England tour of India, there might be tougher days to come. For now, we'll let you go and search for the perfect biryani to round off your week in Hyderabad, and speak again soon.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Okay, chaps. We've heard Vish's attempt to analyse what was, quite frankly, a preposterous performance. Now you get to have a go. To quickly recap, England won the toss and batted, posting 246 in 64.3 overs. Baseball light, you might say. India cruised past them to score 436, and then it all went a bit crazy. Miller, I sense you'll have enjoyed it. What was the most Baz-mazing element for you?
Well, you mentioned, you say there, let's analyse this. The most extraordinary thing about the whole thing is that Bazball completely defies analysis. It literally defies analysis. It spits in the face of analysis. It says, I hear your analysis. I'm not going to listen to a word of it. I'm going to do it the way I do it. And by completely ignoring the facts, it's almost post-truth the way they go about things. They completely ignore the facts that England do not win in India. They completely ignore the facts that Ollie Pope, who, you know, my analysis last week was that Ollie Pope can't cut it in Indian conditions, and lo and behold, I was correct for about 11 balls in the first innings, and then it was completely a different Ollie Pope by the second innings, because basically somehow he was able to go back into that dressing room at the end of that innings, and someone got around him and said, "Hey, Ollie Pope, you're a superstar. You can do this. Just reverse sweep it. Remember, we practiced all that on those crazy wickets in Abu Dhabi," and lo and behold, he produces the greatest innings by an Englishman in Asia. So, I mean, it's just absolute nonsense. There is no analysing Bazball at the moment. It is doing its own thing. And the longer it keeps doing its own thing and making its own truths, the more England will win. It really is an extraordinary cultural event that we're witnessing, I think, rather than the cricket team.
It could make this for a short pod. We'll just sit back and shrug. C'est la Bazball. Matt, we thought at the end of day one, England might have posted a competitive total, given some of the rank turners we've seen in India in recent times. I mean, it sort of turned out that it both was and wasn't the case.
Yeah, it's a very strange one to reflect on, really. I was listening to an interview that Brendan McCullum did on SEN Radio in New Zealand after the game, and then thinking back to what Ben Duckett had said on the first night as well, and sort of trying to talk up England's position in the match, even though by the end of that first day, India had already made a pretty significant dent in the deficit, thanks to Jaiswal's assault on Hartley. And in some ways, this sort of fitted what England seemed to think would happen. I think they thought they would bat first. They thought that the pitch would be pretty hard to bat on in the last innings, which proved to be the case. I don't think they quite necessarily thought that day two would be, the, as it proved, probably the best day to bat when the pitch seemed to sort of slow up a bit and didn't offer sort of sharp turn, I suppose, for the most part. But in some ways, they sort of seemed to read the pitch very well and realised that the thing that they didn't want to do was bat last. But then also, they did also take India took a 190-run first innings lead, so it didn't quite work out as everyone planned. But yeah, it was obviously a pretty extraordinary win. And I suppose you have the two-sided element of it, of one, just the sheer fact of overturning a 190-run deficit in any test match, regardless of any opponent, is pretty remarkable. But then when you bear in mind India's recent history and the fact they'd lost three tests in a decade at home, it's all the more remarkable, and I'm not surprised that this has already been elevated to the pantheon of England's greatest away wins. And I don't think it's just recency bias that makes me think it has to be in the top handful, because when you bear in mind all of those factors, sure, in India were missing a couple of players, but England were too in Harry Brook, and were very limited with the amount that Jack Leach, who was their premier spinner, could actually bowl. I think it's an extraordinary win, and regardless what happens in this series, there will undoubtedly be some kind of response from India, but I hope that it, as a self-contained thing, it can be remembered as one of England's great triumphs. I was thinking back to that win in Chennai 3 years ago, which sort of quickly got forgotten by what came next on that tour. But maybe with hindsight, people should have enjoyed it a little bit more at the time, because very quickly fell by the wayside and was such an incredible win. And this one, I think, similar, although probably slightly more confidence, I would say, from England supporters that this one might last a little longer.
Yeah, I mean, it sets the series up, no doubt about that. Vish said, Miller, that, basically before the series, if England win one test, they'll have done well. They're one from one. I think you tentatively predicted 5-0, although did you row back a bit from that on the last pod?
I did row back a bit, but my point was that if England go in believing that they are going to win every test, therefore it's got to be 5-0, because they're going to believe each time they go into the test, take each test in isolation, which they do, and each test is an England win in waiting, therefore 5-0. So that was my logic. I did row back and say, we'll probably end up, they'll win two, and then we'll hedge our bets for the rest. But, you know, that again is kind of how England go about their cricket. They don't focus on the result. They focus on the process. And if the process ends up in a result, then the process has gone well. And if it doesn't, then they pretend it doesn't happen and realign the truths and on we go. You know, it is extraordinary, but it's as I said before, it's a Jedi mind trick rather than a tactic. It's certainly not a gimmick, as it might have been described as by one of our colleagues on this site earlier on in the Test match. I mean, there's, you know, not naming names, there's going to be a lot of humble pie to be eaten by a lot of people all around the world because of the way England are playing their cricket at the minute. It doesn't make sense that England can just subvert the norms of Test history, let alone Test technique and all the rest of it. But they have done, and they've done so with such an extraordinary confidence. Confidence is, frankly, the key. Confidence is what has allowed them to just walk out into a Test match in India and decide, you know what, the reverse sweep is our most logical way of defending the ball. I mean, literally, that's what England have decided. It's like, we're not going to prod. I mean, you know, Vish was talking about Ben Stokes' influence, but it's extraordinary, isn't it? We think back to the start of the whole Baswell era and the manic, crazy batting that Ben Stokes was producing. He was almost throwing himself off his feet in a bid to almost show the rest of his team, look, if I'm going to just play like a clown, then it doesn't matter how you play. And now suddenly it's almost as if he's completely subverted in this Test match, having played a very good innings first time round. Second time round, he actually plays the dead bat, perfectly straight, block for your life, dig for victory innings that England have tried to play all down the years, and then gets bowled by Jaffa and has gone nowhere. And in so doing, kind of proves a point that, you know what, lads, this isn't the way you do it out here anymore. You do not just play with a straight bat and wait for the one with your name on it. You get down on your one knee, reverse it, ramp it over your head, do whatever you like just to get off strike, get the boundary if it goes to it, but keep the scoreboard ticking in the between whiles. And by the end of that second innings, you know, you look at the way that Ashwin and Jadeja, England tormentors year in, year out in Asia, were just being picked off at rates that they'd never gone before. Ashwin was made to look as impotent as I've ever seen him in a Test match, just bowling darts effectively by the end of it. Well, Jadeja, I mean, he's never been dismissed like that in a home Test ever. I mean, both innings, it was 4.88 the first innings, 3.88 the second. He's never gone at that rate in a home Test in a spell of any significance before in his life, let alone twice in the same Test. England have laid a marker in this Test, which, as you've mentioned, the Chennai Test last time around was extraordinary. It was a very different circumstance back then. It was basically Joe Root playing a masterful innings and the rest of England just clinging on his coattails. This time around, you know, Joe Root, Ben Stokes, second time around, they didn't actually play huge roles with a bat. It was down to everyone else chipping in the best possible way they could, and Ollie Pope playing the masterful innings that we've seen. You know, saw Zach Crawley play a masterful innings in the Ashes. We've seen Harry Brook play an absolutely masterful innings in, Mount Maunganui, wasn't it? You know, we've seen masterful innings have basically cropped up in most of England's recent victories. And they've come from different people all the way along. And it's because of this belief that, you know what, go out and do your best. We will back you if it goes wrong. And that unequivocal 100% four square backing every time you go and play a shot is something that no team in the world can replicate, certainly not India. I mean, this is one of the problems that India are going to have in trying to find a way to fight back here. And it is a fight back now, because, you know, the weight of expectation, the crushing demands of a home public that is not used to India losing, let alone being outgunned with a bat. It's a different dynamic when you're expected to try and fight fire with fire, you know, try and play those reverse sweeps. Are you really going to be able to play the reverse sweeps with the freedom that England are playing with them, and risk getting caught with, you know, the fields that Ben Stokes is going to set for those reverse sweeps? It's a dichotomy that's, you know, on the one hand, England have set the agenda here. The other hand, they've set the trap. It works on whichever way they spin it from here. So it's going to be fascinating. And I mean, every chance that England will blow it like they did in the Ashes, they'll lose a match that they could win, and all the other things that come into the baseball factor. But I don't think there's any chance they're going to take a backward step from here on in. And for that very reason, it's going to be a fascinating rest of the series.
Well, 14 wins from 19 now. It's clearly going pretty well by that measure. Matt, if we can't analyse baseball, we can perhaps look at India's response to it. They were, you know, this is a dominant team in their own conditions, completely on top for the first 2 days, but crumbled in the face of a risk-embracing knock from Ollie Pope, but previous top scorer in India, 34. And then a debutant spinner who'd only bowled in the fourth innings six times in his first-class career coming into the game. It surely, on some level, is India complicit in their own downfall.
Yeah, I think that's pretty hard to argue with. I think generally, I think this is probably about as weak as India's batting lineup has been in Test cricket since I can remember, really. And that's even bearing in mind a side that scored 430 odd in the first innings. But particularly when you take out Jadeja and KL Rahul in the next Test, who have been ruled out with injuries. I mean, you look through the side that they're likely to play, they're going to be giving probably a debut to either Rajat Patidar or Sarfraz Khan. And then they'll probably have a slightly longer tail, I would guess, with Jadeja not playing, just because he can balance the side so well at number six. And if you think of the Indian size that we've had in the last, 20 plus years, really pretty much in my lifetime, then I don't think there's been an Indian Test team that's looked worse on paper as a batting lineup. I think there's a stat going around that Joe Root on his own has more Test runs in his career than the entire Indian squad for the next Test. Which is pretty extraordinary. So yeah, maybe there is an element of inexperience in it. I'm not entirely sure, but I think it was pretty notable how, you know, India in that final innings, they actually batted a fairly significant length of time within the context of a fourth innings. They batted for 70 overs, but they weren't at less than 3 and over. Now, if England had been chasing 230 on a fourth day pitch, I can say pretty happily, I think, that they wouldn't have taken it much beyond 50, probably not even much beyond 40, because they would have thought that the best way to counter a sharply turning ball on a final day pitch was going to be to have a swing, because inevitably, you know, we saw with, for example, Hartley's dismissals of Rohit Sharma and KS Bharat, two balls that pitched in pretty similar areas, one that skidded on and trapped Rohit LBW, and one that turned sharply and took out Bharat's off stump. When you consider that, England were likely to take 10 wickets if they bowl for as long as 70 overs. It will be interesting to see how India respond to it in the rest of the series. I mean, they're obviously 2-0 down against baseball now, if you bear in mind the Edgbaston Test in 2022 as well. And they're also, you know, they've not won in the last three home Tests, which is the first time that's happened in a decade. They almost tied themselves in knots against Australia in the third Test of that series about 10 months ago in indoor, where they produced a raging Turner and got beaten. And then they drew a high-scoring game at Ahmedabad in the last game of that series, where they sort of needed to bat out for the draw just to keep the series at 2-1 to them. I really don't know where they go from here. Like, are they going to prepare a pitch that has a bit of green on it and back their seamers? I've honestly no idea, because they, as you sort of hinted at, they do seem, I suppose the word is rattled by what they're coming up against. Like, throughout Pope's innings, I mean, there were, you know, obviously he'd scored quite a few runs by the time he was offering chances, but there were quite a few chances or half chances that weren't taken. There was a sort of comical misfield at Deepman Wicket. It just looked a little bit like a side that that wasn't quite there. And yeah, I've no idea what we're going to see from them in Vizag, but they need to respond very quickly.
Rattled, I'm glad someone's used that word.
I had to get it in.
Well, it sounds like we're definitely on the way to 5-0. Milo, I mean, there were lots of moments in individual performances. Vish has spoken a lot about Pope and Hartley, but I mean, the captain, Ben Stokes, the magic man. I mean, he top scored with the bat in that first innings. A slightly curious effort second time round. I mean, he seems to have settled actually into his role now. Is I'm going to take as long as I like to get in, and then eventually I'll pull the trigger as he did in that first innings of 70. We know about his influence as a captain, but we questioned his fitness and so on after that knee surgery. There was a bit of Stokes brilliance in the field as well in that chase. Just, I mean, India were wobbling clearly. They lost their fourth wicket just after tea. It was on that fourth day, and you know, you really began to sense England were kind of the jaws of the trap were closing. But the run out of Ravindra Jadeja was just extraordinary.
It was absolutely magical, because it was on so many levels. Because on the first hand, Jadeja is one of the fastest players in the team, and so you could tell that Stokes clocked this from the moment the ball came to him. He realised, this is Jadeja, he's quick, I don't have time to field this, I've just got to throw this in mid-air, off balance. He had to trust his knee first and foremost, which is probably the greatest part of the whole thing from an England perspective, is that, you know, the thing about Stokes, and there was a lot of talk, Vish was mentioning how he'd had to relearn his technique in the nets to remind himself that the shots he used to play that hurt him no longer hurt him, so he can trust himself again. Here was proof that he can trust his knee, because this was a guy who had to fling himself low, maintain his balance in his knees essentially, and then unleash in midair. He almost got it, came out the side of his hand in the manner of his shy, because he didn't have time to line up at all and nailed it. It was extraordinary instinct, but also game smarts as well, realizing the identity of the player running towards him and the need for everything to happen in absolute fast forward. So you know, that's in microcosm the sort of acute game awareness that Stokes has got at the moment. I mean, he is absolutely masterful as a captain and a leader. I mean, we talk about it on innumerable pods at the moment, but the tactical nous that he brings to this team is such a huge advantage in just bringing through everyone, not least, I mean, Tom Hartley. We barely talked about his impact and the way in which he fought back from that in ignominious first over. I mean, you know, we saw Simon Kerrigan trending on Twitter on that first day. It was brutal. You know, Simon Kerrigan got battered out of the attack on his debut 10 years ago at the Oval. His figures, in fact, I mean, Matt was crunching them. I think it was 9 overs 53, wasn't it, or something like that, 8 overs 53. And you know, Kerrigan's figures were actually better than Hartley's were at the same point of his first day in the job. And Kerrigan never bowled another over again in his Test career. And Hartley instead had Stokes' arm around him saying, come on, lad, keep going. I mean, admittedly, it was helped or hindered, whichever way you want to put it, by the fact that Jack Leach had a knee injury. But equally, I wouldn't be surprised if Stokes would have done that anyway. Just thinking, you know what, it's the first Test of five. It's actually more important that I get my spinner, who I have faith in, into the game, into the belief that he belongs here, than it is to win this mini period of this particular passage of this five Test series, if you see what I mean. So the manner in which he just puffed him up and bigged him up and just allowed him to come out in that second innings and do his thing. I mean, there were two factors also that came into it. Vish touched on it in his piece with Hartley yesterday. One of them was Jeet Mittal, whose second day quotes were among the most extraordinarily optimistic I've ever heard. And yet, you know, you read them back now, and you know, the notion that England were looking forward to batting again in the third innings because the pitch had slowed down, they were looking forward to seeing where they could take it. I mean, it reads like a prophecy, whereas at the time it read like delusion. But one thing he said to Hartley was, you know, just slow your run up, run up, down, and make sure that you just focus on the final split second of your release. And, you know, release point was what got him picked in the first place. And so Patel's advice to him was, okay, forget about running in, forget about rushing through your job, just remember that release point and part the action from as high a point as possible. And lo and behold, he picks up a 7-footer. But the other key factor, and this again is where the psychology is just on a different level, was the fact that apparently all the team just got round Hartley and didn't talk at all about his bowling, just talked about him boshing Ashwin over the top for the first six of England's tour, let alone the first six of his career. The first six that anyone scored in this Bazball team in India was from Tom Hartley in the lower order. And so the team were bigging him up, pumping up his tyres, reminding him about, oh, wow, what an awesome shot that was. I mean, you know, everyone talks about it. There's so many players who talked about how they just feel a million feet tall when they are in this England dressing room. And you cannot deny the evidence is what we've got. You've got Will Jacks in Rawalpindi, got Rehan Ahmed in Karachi, and now Tom Hartley here in Hyderabad. Three debutant England spinners with barely a first-class wicket behind them, and three of them now with debut five-wicket hauls for England in an England Test victory. It's absolutely preposterous, and it's such a preposterous fact that it can't be a fluke. Stokes' captaincy, particularly his captaincy of young spinners, is as good as I've ever seen. I mean, you know, the great Shane Warne forever said his favourite line about spinners was, spinners need a lot of love. You know, you're going to bowl a full bunger. You're going to have a day when someone just clobbers you out of the park and you've got to come again and do your thing. You've got to have someone who's going to back you, get their arm around you, pump your tyres up and trust you. And Stokes does absolutely all of that every single time England go out to play. And it's incredible. There is no one like him in that regard. And you look at Kerrigan's career, you look at any other England spinner who came and went in the course of 20, 30, 40 years, and all of them would be looking enviously at what Single have got right now and thinking, you know what, if only I'd had a man who believed in me like that. I always had the technique. I could always turn the ball. That's why I got picked in the first place. But being trusted to do your thing day in, day out is another thing entirely.
We'll add horse whispering to the list of Stokes attributes. It's Hartley, second first class five for Matt. You actually went looking for answers here and had a chat with Lancashire spin bowling coach Carl Crowe. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
What have sort of been the biggest areas of development, I suppose, for him as a Red Bull bowler? Because I suppose looking at what his role is in T20, often just by virtue of his bowler type and when he bowls, he's often quite, I would say, defensive. Whereas obviously he seems to have developed the attacking side of his game quite a lot in Red Bull cricket.
Yeah, that's accurate, I think. Definitely getting more on the ball, definitely seeing position. I think when we first started working those years ago, the seam would be scrambled a lot. If you watch some of the footage from this game, seam seemed, you know, pretty rock solid, doesn't wobble, doesn't scramble. So that's definitely an area where he's made significant progress. Definitely the resilience. You know, we probably all read and heard some things after the first day, and you know, the people that wrote that might look hard back on themselves and, you know, reflect maybe they jumped to some conclusions early. But if you look at what he does for Lancashire and for Manchester, and that probably won't, no one would like to hear the 100 we spoke about during the Test cricket chat, but he bowls tough overs for us all the time. He bowls tough overs at Lancashire, he bowls tough overs at Manchester, he bowls with a short leg side boundary, he bowls at the best batters, he bowls at all that stuff, and never ever once questions it. Just, yep, I'll do it, no problem. And, you know, in fact, we were chatting this morning, and we were chatting a lot about, you know, first innings, second innings, and it's the resilience is built up without a conscious conversation around it. It's just what he does. What he does is bowls tough overs, and if he gets hit, just keeps coming back. There's no, you know, in-depth conversation around it. There's no, you know, talking from a psych perspective. It's just, are you doing it or not? Yes, I'm doing it, and whatever is asked to the team, he just does it, and definitely the resilience builds up over bowling in power play, you know, bowling at the best players consistently just becomes a norm for him. So the the, you know, the resilience to, you know, get put under pressure in the first innings. You know, there's obviously, I mentioned there that, you know, there's some over the top kind of language used by, you know, certain people. Just what you do is just, well, that's what it is. I'm just going to get on with bowling my next ball and bowling my next spell and doing the job for the team. And that's what he's done for, you know, he's ingrained that in his game for 3 or 4 years, albeit more white ball. But the resilience people are talking about, it's just, it's been built up and developed, you know, over the period of time. Does that make sense, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was going to ask as well whether there was anything sort of specific that the pair of you would have worked on before he went out for India, because obviously this tour sort of seems to have been on his radar for a little while and he's been preparing for it.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, we definitely talked about it. Funnily enough, even before that, going back to the summer, you know, we've done some work on his action, and one of the players we were continually comparing to was Jadeja, his action, lots of comparisons, and we've talked about how he bowls, and, you know, and not just for India, but for, you know, red ball, and as the India became more and more on the radar and more, you know, obviously was going to be going, then yeah, there's been lots of stuff, and, you know, even again chatting to him this morning, he's able to, you know, what, there's two things really. There's being able to specifically deliver in the conditions, and also adapt to what he's learned. And I think he read somewhere that he mentioned about facing Jadeja and Ashwin helped him learn about bowling the second innings. And I think there's two things, but there's developing his game, and then in order then to be able to adapt to what's required. And I think, you know, there's evidence there that he's gone and done that, really.
In terms of sort of, you mentioned resilience, obviously, but it seemed like he also was quite good at sort of adapting through the game and learning, as you say, from what he'd seen both in the first innings and then when he was batting as well. I suppose particularly, you know, sort of dream left arm spinner's delivery to get Bharat on the final day. That would probably be a good example of him being a thinking cricketer. And despite what you said earlier, and
yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, he absolutely is a thinking cricketer. I'm probably talking well off field now, that, you know, if he gets grief for that. But, you know, he's absolutely a thinking cricketer. But also, you know, the Bharat one will get all the notice, but the Rohit one that didn't spin and went straight on, equally, you know, we've talked consistently about beating both sides of the bat as a natural variation. You know, spinning the ball, if you spin the ball hard with that sort of shape on the ball, some will go straight on, some will spin. And again, you know, we keep using Jadeja all the time as a sort of, you know, here's a framework to work from. Jadeja does that very well. Some skid on, some spin. If that natural variation, you know, got no idea as a bowler what's going to happen, the batter's got no price. And, you know, Rohit played for spin and LBW, and then Bharat, you know, again, a beauty. The ball's probably landing in a similar position, delivered from a similar angle. One spins, one goes straight on, you know. And you know, again, Axar, someone we've talked about, learning from him. It's what he does very well. So it's yeah, so I think it's learning from what others do, but adapting that to your own style, really. So, and just, you know, the one thing we talk about consistently is keep bowling your best ball. And in that, you know, I actually thought you bowled okay first innings. They obviously went at him for a number of reasons. The context is you're playing your test, they're making their debut, you're opening the bowling as a spinner against some of the best players spinning in the world. And I think that context must almost always be given when you're sort of observing what's going on. But, you know, he got out there and just, you can see, obviously you saw him a little bit nervous to start with and him growing confidence as he went on. But actually, it's just like to keep doing the same thing. Whatever the batters are doing, whatever the conditions are doing, let it be. Just, you know, stay present and keep doing the same thing. And he did that. And, you know, he's already in the first 4 days of his test career ridden the wave of, you know, international cricket and being in the spotlight.
Yes, I mean, Matt, as kind of you discussed there, very different skill sets for red ball and white ball. Hartley's hugely more experienced as a white ball bowler, but this wasn't just a hunch, you know, to pick him for the test squad. I think, as you wrote before, when the squad was announced, this was database with the iHawk cameras that they use on the county circuit now.
Yeah, and I think from what I understand, there was a fair bit of research as well, rather than simply a case of looking at bowlers that have done well in India, and particularly in Axar Patel, and trying to find the Englishman who had the most similar frame and bowling action. I think there was a fair bit of research done on sort of which factors contribute towards success of test bowlers in India, or have done over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. And yeah, I mean, centered on, you know, speeds and release points is their two big areas, and Hartley, you know, measures up pretty well in those. I mean, in white ball cricket, which is where you see most of the sort of televised speed guns, he's regularly into the sort of low 60s miles an hour, you know, over 100 kilometres an hour. And I think that's backed up pretty well by iHawk as well. But I suppose part of the skill was the fact that he actually, you know, had the wisdom to adapt to what was in front of him and actually changed his pace a lot in England's second innings with the ball. You know, he was dragging it right back at times and varied his pace really well. But yeah, I suppose at the time that squad was selected, there was a lot of talk about Liam Dawson, wasn't there? And the fact that he'd obviously had a stellar county championship season and been overlooked. And I think not many people, probably myself included, took Rob Key entirely at face value when he said that Hartley had been simply selected on merit ahead of Dawson. Key's point was that he had the attributes to succeed in India. And much as Dawson had a great year bowling, you know, at the Aegeus Bowl in the cold, that didn't necessarily translate to Hyderabad in January. And I think most people thought that the context of Dawson having a pretty lucrative contract in the SA20 was a big determining factor there as well. And in fact, what we've seen is, has very much vindicated Key and the rest of the selection panel and England's sort of talent ID. That has aged remarkably well so far at this stage, at least, in that selection. Because, well, I mean, to be honest, I don't think many people expected Hartley to play in this test, let alone to be effectively become the main spinner, or one of two main spinners along with Joe Root, because you know, Rehan Ahmed didn't have a huge role, particularly in the second innings, and Jet Leach was obviously carrying that knock. So for him to have impressed quite as he did was remarkable. And as I say, you've got to doff your cap to the talent pathway, the talent ID guys at England, and say that was a pretty good pick.
England can obviously make whatever sort of selection punts they want from now on, Miller. The suggestion seems to be that Leach might well be fit to play in Visakhapatnam. There was obviously Root took on a big bowling workload in that first test. I think the most overs he's delivered in a match in his test career. And Brendan McCullum has even floated the possibility of an all-spin attack at some point in the series. Shoaib Bashir has arrived after his visa issues. Whatever England do from now on, I mean, we sort of expect it to turn to gold.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, you could argue that England picked the wrong team for this test and probably had the worst of conditions in many ways because, as Matt mentioned, that first innings, it was actually ragging quite a lot because it was a quicker pitch. And so, you know, arguably batting first wasn't the right thing to do, although bowling last clearly was. So, you know, England's probably, in hindsight, would have wanted two quicks at some stage. And yet, England, in hindsight, don't do hindsight. England will probably go into the next test thing, you know what, we'll pick the same team. What the hell? It's like on Twitter, Peter Miller, the cricket geek, has a running joke that every time a test match finishes, he will name his team for the next test match. And it's exactly the team that's lost. And it always winds up someone gets caught by the trolling on Twitter and says, what a ridiculous team. You're completely out of your mind. This is probably what England will do. They'll say, you know what? What the hell? I mean, Mark Wood bowls 8 overs, does nothing. Billy bowled quite quickly, had a drop catch. He's in. Rehan Ahmed got tonked out of the attack, but he batted quite nicely. He's in. Jack Leach had a hurty knee, but what the hell? He'll be right. He's in. Tom Hartley's gold. He's in. I mean, you know, why would you drop anyone? You know, England has stuck with Zach Crawley through thick and thin because they are absolutely mindful of continuity. They've won an incredible test with the 11 guys on that pitch. Why would you change anything? Why would you dampen someone's spirits within that dressing room by saying, sorry, we thought you were the weak link last week on your bike? I mean, you know, that said, I think there is a pragmatism has snuck into the England's Baswell very, very surreptitiously, I'd add, probably as a consequence of the Ashes. I think they got a bit of a rude awakening by going 2-0 down in the Ashes by being a little bit too clever for their own good. and then got their act together, started stopped sort of banging on about saving cricket and just gone on about beating Australia. And I think there's a little bit more pragmatism has snuck into England by stealth since the Ashes. And so therefore, they're probably in a better place to be able to make tactical switches and mark them up as, yeah, you know, it's just different conditions. And, you know, no slight on Rehan, say, if we decide that James Anderson is a better bet for what's likely to have a bit more grass in Vizag or whatever the reasoning may be. But having said that, you know, I would not be remotely surprised if England just named the same 11 probably tomorrow. I mean, why not? 48 hours out, 72 hours out from the start. Just, yeah, here you go. Here's our team. Cards on the table. Eat that. I mean, that's you know, they just don't care. this is part of their extraordinary secret of their success.
And the problems on the selection front are India's to deal with Jadeja out and KL Rahul out of the next game. Obviously, Kohli still missing for personal reasons. Just one last thing, really, I suppose. But this was a banner day for Test cricket because, a few hours earlier, you'd had Shamar Joseph and West Indies winning in Australia for the first time in 27 years or whatever it was. I mean, KP, dearly beloved Kevin Peterson, we've been philosophising on Twitter about what this means. Test versus T20. Matt, as our resident young person, is this sort of thing, you know, this sort of day when everyone gets really excited about tests happens, you know, a few times a year maybe. Is that enough to make you consign your T20 franchise data cards to the bin and say, give me Red Bull?
Well, of course not. I think as with anything, you want a balanced diet, don't you? And I think sometimes personally, I think it's obvious that Test cricket has been massively elevated by a generation of players that have grown up on white ball cricket. I think it's hard to argue with that, based especially when you look at this England team. I don't think they'd be playing the way that they have done so successfully if so many of them hadn't had the natural inclination to play aggressively, having grown up with limited overs cricket as if not on a par with, then at least very much in their thoughts as well as first class cricket. It always does amuse me a little bit on days like Sunday, where you have people coming out with these incredible statements about sort of the future of the game and everything. I think you have to, you know, clearly that was a fantastic day of Test cricket, but you can understand why market forces have reached the point where they have. I mean, you know, Shamar Joseph wheeling away, celebrating an incredible moment, and drawn huge interest around the world, but was watched by, I think, 3,100 people at the Gabba, which is, you know, that's a non-league football crowd in England. And, you know, you also have these sort of strange things where people start coming out with, you know, I saw Pat Cummins say after that game, you know, he didn't mind the result too much because he was a Test cricket fan. And I thought, you can only really get away with saying stuff like that in this sport. Can you imagine if after, I don't know, Roy Hodgson after England had lost to Iceland saying it was great to see as a football fan? It just doesn't really work for me. But clearly a great day of Test cricket. But I think, you know, we see these days quite often, and we see the response to it is always, you know, something must be done about this, but then nothing is ever done because fundamentally you have a small number of self-interested boards controlling this game. And that's been the case for, you know, if not just the last decade, it's probably been the case for pretty much the history of the sport. And much as it would be great to see something change, and I do feel there is some level of groundswell against the power of T20 leagues, particularly I think the ILT20 in the UAE, which obviously offers such competitive salaries, and with the time of year and with the clash with SA20, seems to me to be the biggest sort of problem out of any franchise league at the moment. I think the genie's out of the bottle. You've got players already over there. You've got the tie-ins with IPL franchises. I think unless that league fails for commercial reasons, that I just can't really see anything changing. And I think that's the reality of it. What a positive, upbeat note to end the pod on.
Well, isn't it? It's all just lip service, isn't it? I mean, you know, I'm very willing, very, very willing, incidentally, to eat some humble pie here because I wrote off West Indies like everyone did. I mean, I said it was a disgrace, the team they'd sent out there, not a disgrace on the part of West Indies because they, as Matt eloquently put it, are victims of circumstance. I didn't say they were weaklings. I said they were victims of circumstance in that, you know, for all the reasons mentioned, they can't pick their strongest side. And so for them to go and do what they did is absolutely magnificent. But it counts for absolutely nothing in the bigger picture unless some administrators seize on to the momentum, seize on to the excitement, seize on to the fact that people give a damn about this and monetize it. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's, you know, increasingly looking as though... I'm looking at England, frankly. The ECB and Cricket West Indies really ought to... You know, Donald Trump's trying to tear up NATO, but I think there's a North Atlantic Treaty Organization that West Indies England should be looking into right this minute, to be perfectly honest. I think there's an awful lot to be said for those two markets combining. They are the favourite destination of England tourists in the winter to go out and watch in the Caribbean. Everyone loves it. And everyone loves the West Indian players succeeding. And I think there's an awful lot of sense in the ECB thinking, you know what, West Indies should perhaps be a pet project of ours because we care about Test cricket. And if everyone is going to forever say, oh, Test cricket's so much better if West Indies are strong, well, someone needs to bloody make them strong. Someone needs to inject them some proper funding, give them a chance to be strong again, be competitive, be a proper player in the world stage rather than relying on a guy like Shamar Joseph who played an absolute unequivocal blinder. But, you know, his subsequent comments saying, I'll always be available for West Indies, I'll always put Test cricket first. I mean, I'm sorry, that's lip service. I mean, of course he's got to say it at that moment, but there's absolutely no bloody chance when he gets thrown a massive IPL contract next week. It's like, you know, I'm sorry, Shamar Joseph, it was a wonderful moment, but you probably won't be seen again in Test cricket in the carefree guise that you produced at the Gabba so wonderfully, because you will be a pawn of Rajasthan Royals or whatever it is, and off you go. It's the market will talk unless someone somewhere at an administrative level decides the market needs to be broken up and reformed, and the only way you'll do that is with a bit of vision and a bit of inspirational leadership, frankly, because otherwise you're just going to get to this endless cycle, come to a day like this every two or three years, think, oh, isn't Test cricket wonderful? It's like, yes, it is. We know it's wonderful. You keep bloody saying it's wonderful. Do something about it. Save it. God damn it.
Can I make the point quickly as well that but for the ILT20 and for Jason Holder's huge contract with Dubai Capitals, Joseph might well not have actually played at the Gabba as well. So that's the controversial line that no one wants. Why West Indies actually have Dubai Capitals to thank for their win in victory.
There we go. I hope to read that piece on the site soon. And yeah, certainly I think a manifesto for helping West Indies win more in Australia is one that most Englishmen can get behind. I think that's enough from us for today. There are four more tests left in the series and we need to keep something in the tank. The Vizag test starts on Friday with India in a spin and not the way they like it. We'll be back next week to see whether England defied the odds again. Until then, my thanks to you, Miller and Matt. Please feel free to rate us on your preferred pod platform and stay tuned to ESPNcricinfo.com for all the latest.